Once again, it's Poetry on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Mark Schwieber is our guest today. You know him as the former mayor of Rock Island, but he's here today as a poet. Garrison Keillor and the Writer's Almanac are also featured on Scribble. Mark Schwieber, it's a pleasure to have you on the program today, and since we're winding up Poetry Month, I think we ought to start with a poem.
All right.
How about, well, obviously, one of yours.
Well, all right. I wrote this poem back in November. I actually had occasion to take my nephew, who's a freshman at Augustana College, out to the airport before dawn. I was catching the red-eye special out west. And as I was driving out there and back, I just kind of noticed some of the things that happen at dawn. So the poem is entitled On the Dawn. The opaque, unyielding dark, broken only by a brazen blue glow of street lamps, reluctantly succumbs to the gray, then amber light of morning with the new day's dawn. For those who slumber, this daily epiphany is missed. When shadows of night give way to daybreak with the new day's dawn, what new insight, what fresh perspectives may accompany the morning? What dread, drear hobgoblins of night are scattered by first light with the new day's dawn? Silence at this early hour when humanity barely stirs gives serene stillness that overlays all. As rested, minds engage with the new day's dawn. Shapes emerge from shadow, fields, farms, factories take familiar form. The curtain opens on a new act, when anything is possible. Dawn's daily lesson in hope.
So that's what it's like in the morning. I've never
I'm a morning person, Don.
Clearly you are.
For Don, morning is about 1 p.m.
Well, I try not to
see what you're missing out on.
Yeah, well, it all sounds wonderful.
You probably do it at the other end of the day, Don.
Let's play the devil's advocate for starters. Why bother to write that down?
Well, that's an interesting question.
I mean, why poetry, I guess, is what I'm asking.
I will find myself at various points, I think we all do, where we'll see something that particularly moves us, something that needs to be communicated to other people in a way that you hope will move them in the same way that whatever it was you experienced moved you. I suppose it was that which Oliver Wendell Holmes, the 19th century poet, was speaking of at too many people die with their music still inside of them. And I think it's that music that's prompted by an outside experience that prompts me to write poetry and also prompts me to do painting. The idea is to try to capture something of the magic and the mystery of the, sometimes the majesty of a particular moment or experience that you want to put down on paper and try to encapsulate in such a way that it might touch in another person what you felt.
I've spoken many times of my fear of putting something on paper. I prefer to be a person moved by poetry rather than to presume to write it. Seems to me a daring thing to do.
Well, it's all, I think, a matter of your perspective. If it's something that you feel strongly moved to, and I know you have never been one to be afraid to express your feelings about subjects or your commitments and convictions about things, and this is just another form of doing the same thing, I think. I put it down once. One of the verses that I included in a book that I published about a year ago was entitled Pilgrim Voices. And the last of the voices, these are all vocations of different people, everything from fishermen to lawyers to doctors to nurses.
Read that for us.
And the last verse is entitled The Poet, and it sort of summarizes my thinking about poetry. It says, by meter and verse, by rhythm and rhyme, are the words that I weave a song of my time. A parable written in few words and spare, seeking sense of a moment or setting that's there. To be frozen in space, an amber of thought, to inspire, refresh, and, for the willing, be taught. I'm often condemned for impractical ways, yet what's life without spirit or beauty, I say? A song without melody, a dawn without color. This is the world without poets' wonder. And that's sort of the spirit, I think, of what I like to believe poetry should do. And when I'm moved by a poem, that's usually what moves me, is the ability to express that concisely.
Well, W.H. Auden is famous for his phrase, poetry makes nothing happen. But I think you've given the lie to that, right? And your intention is to give the lie to that. One of the things that it really intrigues me about your poetry is that you're almost alone among poets in the Quad Cities and in the United States, I suppose, who use verse and rhyme.
Mm-hmm.
Is that deliberate, or are you just comfortable with?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing, Roald, because some of the verses, like the first one I read, really has no rhyme to it. It has cadence in it, but it doesn't have rhymed phrases. Sometimes things will move me in a way that I want to rhyme them. A lot of those in The Pilgrim Footsteps, that last section I read, actually the last portion was rhymed, but much of it was not. I don't believe, as Robert Frost once said, that writing poetry without rhyme is like playing tennis without a net. I think that there is a great deal to be said for free verse, you know. But there are times when I find that using rhyme can actually accentuate a point more. So I'll frequently end verses with a rhyming couplet, although the verses themselves may not be rhymed. I think it's a way of adding emphasis to a point.
Do you know that when you begin writing a poem? Why don't you take us through the process of when you're driving along, it's dawn, and do these thoughts occur to you as you're driving, or did you sit down right afterwards as soon as you could?
Well, both, because usually what will happen is I'll be driving along and something will catch me as being particularly beautiful. I might not have thought of a lot about it before, but I've got time to reflect on it, and I'll just look around and see. You know, there is really something astonishing about the serenity of the early morning when things are first coming to life. And usually what I will do is I'll try to capture a few images in my mind, kind of like you take a mental snapshot of something, and that'll incorporate those in a verse. I might write a line or two of the poem mentally, and then when I'll come home, I'll try to flesh it out in a little more fuller embodiment. But usually what I'll try to do while I'm actually on site, it's kind of like when you're painting from nature, you'll try to do a sketch of what you're seeing, and then you'll fill in the details afterwards. Winslow Homer, who's one of my favorite painters, would do that. He would do a watercolor sketch, and then he'd do a finished painting from the watercolor sketch. In some respects, for me, writing poetry is that same way. You'll get the general image in your mind of what you want to express, and then you'll go home and you'll flesh it out.
The whole business of writing things down, I think of Oscar Hammerstein II, well-known lyricist in Broadway musicals. He had a habit of writing down anything that presented itself to him as something interesting. And in Oklahoma, he was able to use a line he had written before, just the one line, "All the cattle are standing like statues."
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly he had occasion to use that line.
Mm-hmm.
That requires more discipline than I can comprehend.
Well, sometimes the line may just come to you in sort of a serendipitous moment. You're thinking about something else, and something that you experienced before comes to mind, and it fits, and it ties it together, and you begin creating connections. And I think that's part of poetry, too, is creating connections between, in this case, for example, the concept on the dawn of a dark, dreary time of the day for many folks, actually being an epiphany when not only is the new day beginning and light emerging, but you see things sometimes more clearly than you do at the end of a day when your mind is weary. I know I find that some of my best thinking occurs in the early morning hours, sometimes too early. I'll wake up and can't get back to sleep. But I think that the whole concept is to be open to those kinds of daily epiphanies that we can experience if we open our senses to the world around us.
Yeah, if serendipity doesn't give it to me, I don't get it.
Right. I think epiphany is a good word for what you've just described, and it probably is at the heart of most of your poems. It occurred to us, Don and I, that to me, I mean, excuse me, English
teacher. You can blame me for anything you're doing.
Just by sheer accident, three of the four people we're interviewing during Poetry Month are lawyers.
Hmm.
Why in the world would that be?
Well, it's probably no coincidence. Abraham Lincoln was something of a poet. In fact, he didn't make a lot out of it, but not only did he enjoy Shakespeare and theater a great deal, which ultimately in some respects proved fatal because he was in Ford's theater when he was shot 150 years ago, but he loved wordsmithing. And that's really what lawyers do, isn't it? It's wordsmithing. So it's not surprising that a lawyer should want to put a little bit different application to that wordsmithing and probably use the other side of the brain than the analytical side they use most of their week to do something where they're using their more creative impulses.
Well, it's one thing I noticed back when I was in the legislature and helping to write law is the power of a single word in a certain place in a sentence and how so much could turn on that. And you had to be careful. You think, what will a lawyer make of this? Have we got it exactly right? And a friend of mine, when I complained about what seemed to me ambiguity, says it never hurts to leave a little ambiguity in the law. But then he was a practicing lawyer, too.
Well, there's that's how lawyers make their trade. But it probably relates to class in Mark Twain when I was at Augustana with this noted luminary sitting to my right, Roll Tweet here. And I remember one of his great phrases was, the difference between the right word and the wrong word is the difference between lightning and a lightning bug.
Did I say that? Who are some of your favorite poets?
Well, I like very much Robert Frost. I enjoy him. I enjoy Carl Sandburg. I don't, you know, do a lot of studying of poets. It's more people that I've come across that I found appeal to me. I must admit, most of my reading is focused more on nonfiction history and things like that, particularly biographies, as opposed to reading poetry. But to the extent that I have read poetry, my tastes in poetry are those that are understandable and that seem intent on expressing not just an emotion, but a thought, an idea, or a value. Maybe that's because I'm a lawyer for a living. One of the criticisms I have of much of modern art and expression is that it can be somewhat self-indulgent, where the artist seems more interested in gratifying his impulses as opposed to expressing something of the mystery or magic of the world around them that they've seen. I feel that any kind of art, whether it's poetry or painting, ought to be ultimately communicative. It ought to communicate something to someone else and not just be sort of narcissistic self-indulgence where a person is unloading his observation.
Why do you think it is then that, that the average person, most people, are fearful of poetry? Or poetry was never my thing, they would say, and I just never got the hang of poetry.
Well, probably in part because times because of the way it was taught. I'm fascinated by history.
Okay, blame teachers. That's right.
But I'm fascinated by history, but I can see where a person could get really turned off to history if the history teacher simply made it a discipline of memorizing dates. That would be extraordinarily boring. It's a story, and you have to view it as a story. And I think with poetry, too often it's been taught as sort of a staid, stuffy, regimented thing. You have to memorize or you have to try to sort out. And sometimes it may even be in a form of English that we're not that conversant with so that it's a little harder to wade through. And then in more modern verse, I think sometimes contemporary poetry can be kind of off-putting because it doesn't really seem to be understandable. It's not approachable for most people. And again, I think maybe I'm in the vast minority in saying this, but I think that a poem should be expressive of something that can be generally understood.
You're not a T.S. Eliot fan, is that it?
Well, even T.S. Eliot is more understandable than... I was thinking when Mark said that, there was a novelist that was somewhat popular back in the 50s, John Hawkes, author of Blood Oranges, who bragged about the fact that he thought only six people in the world could understand his work.
Yeah.
And I thought, is that something to brag about?
Yeah.
Well, local poet Arthur Davison Ficke and Winter Benner put that little satire on modern poetry, which was incomprehensible, and was praised all over the country.
Yeah.
And I thought that ought to have taught us something.
Yeah, exactly.
But, it's true that... I think when I look at T.S. Eliot, it's thick. It's some of it is obscure. and you really have to dig sometimes to figure out exactly what it is. And I think he deliberately planted a lot of things in there. Yeah. He once talked about something that people didn't pick out the word Grimpen as referring to the Moor and Sherlock Holmes and so on. But I love poetry that speaks to me.
Yeah. And well, I think it, what you're saying is it really needs to communicate. If it doesn't communicate, it's missing the mark.
Before we run out of time, why don't you tell us where your book is available? Because I've read it, and I think the kind of audience you're looking for are the kind of people who might be afraid of poetry, and I think they would get over their fear of it if they were to pick up this book and read poems like Dawn.
Well, thank you.
So,
it's available on Amazon.com. I guess that's become one of the great book distributors of today, and that's a place where people can reach it. I'm in the phone book myself, and I can be contacted about it as
but
well.
But do local stores?
I'm not carrying it in local stores at this point.
Okay,
no.
Okay.
It's called Pilgrim Steps?
Pilgrim Footsteps.
Pilgrim Footsteps, okay.
I would suggest that if you're afraid of poetry, buy this book, and you'll be back there with Frost and Oliver Wendell Holmes. And
Well, let's end as we began with a poem, Mark.
Oh.
You have a brief poem that you can lay on us as
well,
we head to
see.
The exit.
I can see if we can't find something here.
Thumb through the book. And
this is one that was written on, this is sort of a metaphor, talking about pebbles in a pond, but it actually refers to human life. The power of pebbles. I tossed a pebble into the pond and watched its circles of energy spread infinitely from where it plunks, concentric rings gliding symmetrically outward to touch the cattails and water grasses or lap gently the farthest shore. How like these pebbles are we, plunked unobtrusively into life's pond, yet making waves from the moment of birth that touch, for well or ill, all about us, the power of pebbles manifest in billions of subtle, varied ways throughout eternity.
Thank you. Mark Swiebert, our guest today, poet and lawyer, a man who obviously knows how to deal with words. Here's another fellow who will give us a poem along with the Writer's Almanac, Garrison Keillor.